But I have a map of the electorate from the 1916 election. I'm holding up to the video cameras, where it is a direct opposite of red and blue states. You have the entire South as blue states, and the North and Midwest, East Coast, West Coast, pretty solid red Republican states. Here to discuss how this massive change of almost direct polarity occurred is Peter Radcliffe, a historian on the subject. Peter, are you there?
I am here, Hunter.
So, yeah, let's get into this. The example I have is 1916, and it's pretty much a direct opposite of, say, like the 2004 Bush election. What was going on, say, about 100 years ago, why the Midwest and East and West Coast were so Republican while the South was so solidly Democratic?
Well, I think that the initial political sort of division was shaped by the Civil War and Reconstruction. And so the Republican Party was the party of emancipation and the party that pushed for the Reconstruction of the South. And that meant the 13th, 14th, and 15th Amendments, the enfranchisement of African Americans, and a more activist government. That shaped then the opposition was in the South and was largely the Democratic Party, which was the party that had opposed the Civil War, had opposed the North, had opposed the emancipation of the slaves. And that continued for a good half a century, even a little bit more. I mean, I think there's also very interesting nibbling away around the edges and in different spaces, so that when you say 1916, that's actually the moment when the Nonpartisan League emerges on the political scene and begins to provide a third-party alternative to both the Republicans and the Democrats. And over the next two decades, particularly here in the Midwest, the Nonpartisan League in North Dakota, the Nonpartisan League and then the Farmer Labor Party in Minnesota, the Progressive Party in Wisconsin, are really indications of the way a kind of political earthquake is building under the structures of the Republican and Democratic Party.
Now,
so that when we get to the 30s, things really change wholesale.
Is the generalization that the Republican Party was a kind of a big city metropolitan party that had still big business interest in mind, but also expanding the role of the federal government, because at that time those ideas helped one another, whereas now big business and less government regulation are kind of the go-to themes of the kind of Republican conservative position, and that the Democratic was more about the states' rights and keeping government small for their state ideas of pushing legislation through?
I think that that's really only true up to World War I. And the 1930s, the Great Depression, really occasions a tremendous shift in the American political landscape. And under particularly Franklin Delano Roosevelt, who is elected president four times in the 30s and through the first half of the 40s, the whole political terrain shifts, and the Democratic Party becomes the party of government intervention in the economy and adopts a form of economic theory and practice called Keynesianism, and that really is part of this big political shift that starts in the 1930s and for the most part continues at least until the election of Clinton in 1992.
Now, you mentioned Franklin Delano Roosevelt. Now, what about the other Roosevelt, Teddy Roosevelt, being a Republican and then forming the Progressive Party? Was Teddy Roosevelt's policies in line with Franklin Roosevelt's at all?
Only in some areas. That okay. is, he was an advocate of protecting the environment and thereby government regulation of development. So he certainly was a believer in a more active government, but he was much less liberal around issues of racial and economic equity than Franklin Delano Roosevelt would be.
Now, is it true that back then both the Republicans and Democrats had notable progressive, socially liberal left wings and socially conservative right-wing factions within their parties, and today you don't see that as much?
Yes, I would say that's certainly true, that there was a spectrum of ideas and ideologies within both parties. It's interesting to reflect on, the discourse that we're in an era where there are cultural wars being fought out in politics, as if that's something new. And we could go back to the 20s and early 30s and the fight over prohibition, or we could go back to the early 20th century and the fight over access to birth control and women's control over their bodies. Fighting over cultural interpretations and standards is nothing new in American politics.
Now, with Franklin Roosevelt and the New Deal, you still had that solid South supporting the Democrats. And does this have to do with that his economic policies benefited the South greatly? And then this shift, or go ahead, touch on that.
No, you've gone right to the, I think, to the heart of what's so interesting about the New Deal. And that is that while there was a liberal, urban, racial equity agenda in the North, that Roosevelt essentially decided not to put pressure on white farmers in the South. So, for instance, when the National Labor Relations Act was passed in 1935, and it was a plan of Roosevelt and his close ally, Robert Wagner, who was the United States Senator from New York, they decided to leave out of the protections of the National Labor Relations Act government employees, domestic workers, and farm workers. And the reason they left farm workers out was that white farmers in the South did not want to face their workers being able to unionize. And so it was a bone that Roosevelt threw to the white South that enabled them. So what looks, I think, to many of us at a distance as the solid South really was quite complicated in terms of both class and race. And Roosevelt was very worried about politicians like Huey Long in Louisiana who were organizing white voters and white working class voters on Roosevelt's right flank. And so Roosevelt essentially sold out African American farm workers in order to hang on to the political loyalties of white Southerners. And he said that he had to do it or there never would have been a New Deal at all. Mm. And it's an interesting thing to think about. Was that the necessary price to have a New Deal agenda at all?
Yeah, that is fascinating. And then fast forward from the New Deal, and you have the next big struggle with the South, with LBJ.
With civil rights.
Yes.
Yeah. Yes.
So I know LBJ was stated as saying that by pushing this Voters' Rights Act, that he was losing the South for a generation. And that kind of did come true. But this was kind of happening before that even. Correct?
Right. I mean, it's another interesting instance, though, of kind of a third party emerging that kind of foretells that there's going to be a big structural political shift. So the emergence of George Wallace within the Democratic Party in 1968, you know, at the same time, there's this great book, The Emerging Republican Majority, by Kevin Phillips, that talks about Richard Nixon's Southern strategy. And you look at Republican politicians like Nixon and Goldwater in the 60s and early 70s. But in a way, they were following what George Wallace, who was the old kind of Democrat in the South, that they were following what Wallace was showing, that white Southerners would do almost anything to prevent being put on the same plane with African Americans.
Hmm. Very interesting. So what did Nixon... So actually, let me rephrase that. What's the difference between, say, an Eisenhower to a Nixon to then a Reagan?
Well, I always think that the present and the past are in a conversation with each other, and that sometimes what we experience in the present enables us to see parts of the past more clearly than we had seen them before. And I think that we're living in a present right now where global capitalism and American capitalism are in crisis, that we got away from Keynesian economics in the mid-1970s and moved into neoliberalism under Reagan. And then that neoliberalism entered a profound crisis in 2008, 2009, 2010, that I think it has not pulled out of, that it is still mired in the crisis, that the financial crisis and banking crisis were the most public reflections of. And so the shift is, it's not only the ideology or cultural stance of an individual politician like Eisenhower or Nixon or Reagan, but it's the way the whole political terrain is responding to either the stability or the instability of the economy that everything sits on top of. And so Eisenhower, you know, really was able to rule at a time when the American economy was booming. And using Keynesian policies to generate demand-driven growth. And as some would say, that it was a tide that lifted all the boats. Nixon is already in a period in the late 60s when we start to see difficulties emerging. And the war in Vietnam is an important reflection of those difficulties. But so was the uprising in Paris in 1968 and the uprisings in Czechoslovakia, the challenges to the military regimes in Chile and Brazil, that the world was becoming much less stable in the late 60s and early 70s.
Yeah.
And Nixon, you know, Nixon was responding to that. And the fact is that Nixon was not successful in developing a strategy to cope with that instability. And Reagan, you know, Reagan really enjoyed that he came to power in a period when the alternative seemed to have disappeared, that the Soviet Union was imploding and the Eastern Bloc was falling apart. And so Reagan had the opportunity to kind of call victory, but it turns out that it did not create stability. And we are all over the world today in a period of great instability. And Trump and people of his ilk, whether it's Theresa May in England or Macron in France or this scary guy in Hungary or this guy who looks like he's going to come to power in Brazil, it looks like the response to the crisis of capitalism as neoliberalism has imploded is to go for, you know, just about fascist dictatorship. And that may or may not succeed, but we cannot ignore that it's happening all over the world and not just in the United States.
I totally agree with that take. And I see some parallels to this time we're in now being a consequence of the Reagan economics, the neoliberalism. And we're facing a point where this is quickly collapsing on us and people are looking for social democratic solutions or democratic socialist solutions like the New Deal. So I totally see that parallel and share those sentiments that you have.
Yeah, I think that this is, we are in a moment where choices are going to be very clear. Part of the challenge will be whether we continue to have the freedom to act on the choices that we might want to make. I worry every day that the 45th president is going to make it unlikely that we're actually able to act on the choices that we may want to make.
I totally agree, but I also feel hopeful that because of these consequences, we could have some bright left-wing progressive solutions, and it just
might
be what was needed to kind of kick people's attention to this. But Peter, we're going to have to go. Thank you so much. It's a fascinating topic, and I really agree with your takes on this situation.
It's a pleasure talking to you, Hunter, and I hope we can talk again soon.
Absolutely. We'll set something up again.
Thank you. All right. Take care.
Take care.